So I was just going to ask you about what inspired you to create Blind Man's Song, who you play, what the story's about, what the process has been like.
I mean, the main question that was leading the original exploration was, why do people kiss? Because obviously people have been painting kisses, sculpting kisses, taking photos of kisses for hundreds of years. And so I was very fascinated by it, and I wanted to explore, a kiss. And so I got a team together, and we practiced a lot. But we didn't find the answer. What we did find, though, is that in the act of kissing, people usually decide to close their eyes. That became the main thing for us. And, that people decided to shut off one of their senses and focus on the world inside, on what was happening inside. And so little by little, we decided to go fully for that, and to really take that to an extreme, and to place the show within the imagination of someone who's never seen the light. And that's where a blind man comes into place. And what was really exciting about this choice is that if you've never been able to see, then your perception of the world is obviously, everything becomes a metaphor, because when you touch something, you have to imagine what it could represent. And so that became very juicy theatrical language, because obviously we, as theatre makers and mimes, we're interested in creating metaphors on stage, and making, what's not visible inside, visible on stage. And so that was really exciting. And following on from that, what became even more exciting is that obviously none of us in the team are blind or visually impaired. So if we wanted to do things correctly, we had to, explore things around the questions like, what does it mean to live in a world with no sight? And so we worked for several months, over a year and a half, with blind and visually impaired people, in North London, with the Haringey Phoenix Group. And so on a weekly basis, I would go in and interview different members as they would be doing daily activities. And that, that was incredibly rich and grounding and fascinating, really, because you do learn about things that you not normally consider. And it helps also us to go beyond the clichés of, obviously people with no sight, they have a better sense of, they hear better, or they touch better, but what's beyond that? And I think that's what was really interesting. And then the last thing that was really inspiring at the start was also, I don't know if you're familiar with the painting by René Magritte, a Belgian painter. Yeah, and maybe you've seen it. It's The Lovers. I mean, obviously all his work is surrealistic work. It's really inspiring, especially for that piece. But this painting in particular was really exciting, because it's two veiled lovers about to kiss. And I think what was really exciting was not so much what they were hiding with the veil, but what they were revealing, I think, is the exciting bit. And I think that's what, we sort of took a little bit of that aesthetic and worked with it in the show, and tried to make it our own. And so that's what we've been working with. And then one last thing that was really inspiring as well was, I mean, the work of Samuel Beckett in general, but specific plays such as, a play that he did for television called Hey Joe. Several characters from him were also really interesting, like Ham, for instance, the blind man in Endgame, was interesting for us, in terms of the look of our blind man, and also the look of his room, this room at the end of the world. So it's a sort of dead end of the world, dead feeling that was really, really precious to us, and that we tried to sort of capture as well in terms of the atmosphere, I suppose. That was really, really inspiring. So in a nutshell, that's how we started.
Yes.
It's a bit much, but yeah.
No, that's fantastic. It's amazing that you're able to draw on so many different inspirations, and especially talking to people who are blind. That must have been really interesting and really helped the process.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that as a company we try to do, and it's a little bit now, a little bit of the ethos of the company is to, whenever we work on a project, we try to find out who in the community could help us make that project, really grounded. so that it's not just us looking ourselves into a room and try to reinvent the world with no grounding. So I guess talking to people who are experts in their field, in the field we're exploring, is crucial. We started doing it a few years ago when we were doing a show called The Gambler, and you know, obviously we could imagine a lot of things around the, you know, gambling addiction, all of that. But the show really transformed when we started chatting and interviewing gamblers, former gamblers from Gamblers Anonymous, and going to meetings and inviting them to come into the show and giving feedback. So that's where it started. And then since then, for every production, we've really tried to engage a meaningful dialogue with different groups, or at least groups that were relevant to the subject matter that we were exploring. So for instance, with Blind Man's Song, not only we interviewed people, but we also invited the people who wanted to come to come and experience the work in the flesh, in the room, in the studio when we were developing it. And so to do that, we worked with a charity that you might have heard of called Vocal Eyes. They're a nationwide charity, and they do audio description. They provide audio description for theatre plays. So usually they work with big Western productions like, you know, The Lion King or you know, Les Mis, and they audio describe the work and they do organize touch tours before the show so that blind people can actually experience the show in their own ways. And so we worked with them. So they would come in, you know, they would come in rehearsal and audio describe the work. I mean, write the audio description, and then when we would have the people from the Phoenix group coming to experience our work, they would audio describe it. And so we had several sessions where, you know, the work was still in development, and they would live audio describe it, so we could hear the audio description as well. And then there would be sighted and non-sighted people in the audience, and so it would be interesting to see what actually happened. And yeah, so that's how we made it. And it was fascinating because it was a little bit about, you know, how you make visual theatre accessible to visually impaired people. So that was a big part of the process. That was the exciting bit.
Fantastic. Back to the story. Who do you play in this piece?
I play the blind man, but the imaginary self. So Alex Judd, the composer and musician, and the actor is performing the blind man in the real world, and I play the blind man in his imagination. I'm his projected self, his dream self, if you like.
Yes. And am I right in thinking you wear a mask or a veil?
Absolutely. So we are, Zelma Ross, who's performing, also performing in the show, is also wearing a veil, a little veil. They can also be seen as a mask. And it's pretty much like in the Magritte painting.
Yes.
It's also something which comes from the tradition that we're coming from in terms of movement. Zelma and I have both trained in dramatic corporal mind. So in this tradition, to cover the face and to let the body speak is sort of seen as the pinnacle of stylization, if you like. So we're using that a lot as well. I mean, obviously, at the end of the day, the show is not a mime show or a corporal mime show. It's a show. It's a concert. It's a theatre play. It's a visual piece. So it's not just a mime piece, but it came from there, from the idea that we wanted to see how, you know, could we make a show without words? Could we make a show without a face? So all of these questions were really interesting.
Yeah, I was going to say, you must have to think about how you convey emotions through movement rather than facial expressions.
Absolutely, and how the body becomes the motor and not the face. And it's fascinating because, I mean, this is going to sound paradoxical, but it seems like you're even more vulnerable as a performer. It seems like you're much more vulnerable behind the veil than you are without. So as if the face acted as an actual mask, and to remove the face makes you even more naked and vulnerable and fragile, and open as well. So I think something that was really interesting for us is to discover this fragility of this vulnerability of because then, the face is not distracting. People are looking at the way you move, and there's so much in just looking at how people move that reveals about, their inner world. So that's what we discovered. So in a way, it's a little bit like when you look at, Commedia dell'arte people or people doing with working with neutral masks. You see a bit deeper actually, which is really interesting.
What do you love about mime?
About mime, oh, I love
Yeah.
absolutely everything about it, and I think what I like even more is that no one really knows what it is, and no one really agrees on what it is.
Yeah.
And to me, mime doesn't mean white face, classical traditional pantomime, with white gloves and white faces,
Yes.
and where someone would try to replace words by silly gestures. I think to me, mime is about making a portrait of things. It's about portraying things, and by things I mean ideas, emotions, thoughts. So it's not about replacing words. It's about saying something else, something that the words are not able to convey. And so to me, mime doesn't mean necessarily silent. We've done pieces where we, a writer has been writing a new play, and then we would develop it together. So to me, mime is really about making a portrait of something with something else. And this something else being your body, and also I mean, this is going to sound really cliche, but I'm absolutely fascinated by the idea of having something invisible and making it visible on stage. I think it's, to me, what mime is about. It's about showing without explaining. It's about letting people see what is happening, and I love it. I absolutely love it. And I like the mystery behind it.
Do you think there's been an increase in popularity over the past few years?
Around mine.
Yes, around mine.
I don't know, to be honest. I don't know. Because it's not a question that that's the way I work. That's the way I want to work. It's what I it's this I use this language to create work. And to make sure it's at the heart of the creative language of the company, of Theatre Re. Now, whether or not it's becoming more popular, I'm not sure. I think we're still fighting against the cliche. We're still fighting against the master and master idea of what mime is. And despite all the brilliant work that is being showcased as part of the London International Mime Festival, for instance,
Yes.
I think we're still fighting against that. Something else that we're still fighting against is that venues around the UK and even in the continent actually, when they program us, they're taking a risk because obviously it's not a dance audience, it is not a theatre audience, it is not a music audience. So what is it? It's a little bit of non-identified object. But that's what I love about it is that at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. I think we're really doing theatre. We're there to communicate a story just differently. And so yeah, it's really about communicating with the audience, and yeah. So whether or not it's more popular, I don't know. I don't think, for instance, circus is becoming really popular and it's becoming a trend, and there's all these circus shows are popping about, and they're brilliant. But about mine, I don't know. I don't know if it's becoming really popular. I don't know. Maybe you should tell me if you think it's becoming really popular.
I think there's definitely an increase. I've noticed it just from working here that there's definitely more mime shows coming to Oxford, which is fantastic.
But I'm glad. I'm delighted to hear that. More work for us.
Yeah. I spoke to a theatre company putting on the piece was called The Kite, and they're performing this part of the London International Mime Festival as well. So it's great.
The tides. Okay, I'll look out for them. I'll look out.
No, really interesting sounding piece. I've got a bit of a silly question now.
Please.
What story or theatre piece would you like to see as a mime performance?
It's an interesting question. I think any story really, any story, any, and I think it's a question of which story would benefit the most to be so visually expressive. If it's the Mousetrap, for instance, where the plot is really thick and it, you know, it's a murder mystery. You need to really follow what's happening on stage, where you know the plot is really thick. So I don't think that would work so well, because obviously the more information there is, the less room for expression, I find. So I think it's about finding stories that everyone knows already, like old myths, for instance, ancient tales, legends, stories that, you know, almost like folk stories that really, you know, that really reach deep down into our collective consciousness, or that really reach beyond a sort of mundane daily life sort of murder mystery. I mean, all respect, you know, all due respect to The Mousetrap, I think it's brilliant. But I think for the sort of work that I like, or that I like to see, or that I'd like to, you know, when the visuals are used so strongly, I think it has to reach to something much more, yeah, much more rooted in what it means to be a human being, what it means to be alive, what common stories do we share, so that people don't have to focus so much on understanding or finding out what the storyline is. So it's much less about the story than history, if you like. So it's about, you know, the history in general, the history of mankind, for instance. So it's much, much more grand, if you like, without being pretentious about it. I think that's an old myth are really exciting, I find.
Yeah.
But again, maybe it can just be a story about, you know, an encounter between a man and a woman, and how that encounter triggers the imagination, which is what we're doing. So, does that answer your question? I'm not too sure.
It's raised some interesting points. Yeah, it's great. And what is next for Theatre Ari?
So Theatre Ari, we're developing a show at the moment called The Nature of Forgetting, and it's our working title. And it's our most ambitious project to date. We're about 7 performers on stage and about 12 creators involved. And we started last December, and we're still in the process. We're going to have another 2 weeks of R&D in June, and hopefully we'll open in early 2017. So it's a project obviously about memory, but more than memory, it's about forgetting. And by forgetting, I think it's about the question that we're trying to answer, or maybe not to answer, but we're trying to tackle off stage, is what does it mean? What is left when memory is gone? What is left of us when memory is gone? And so we're trying to find what is common to everyone, to every human being. I guess it's what I was saying earlier. What does it mean to be alive? Is what we're trying to show. So it's very. I don't know if you know a play called by Thornton Wilder, the American playwright, called Our Town. So we're not doing Our Town, but in terms of the atmosphere of what we want to play, the show to communicate, it's very similar. It's and also Thornton Wilder do ask the question in the play: what is left when memory is gone? What is left of us? What do we all have in common? Mm. Yeah, what does it mean to be a human being? I guess is the main question behind that. So it's all very. It's always philosophical, but in fact it's actually really simple, and it's about what you see and how you construct and deconstruct memory, and how when you forget, it's not that it's disappeared, but it's about the fact that it's not accessible anymore, and we play a lot with that. So yeah, it's an exciting project.
That's such a long process.
Yeah, you're right, it is a long process. It takes, I mean, I think the usual, you know, the usual standard rehearsal period is, you know, six weeks rehearsal, and then you open straight away. For us, it's very different. For us, it takes about 15 weeks over a 2 year period before we, I mean, 2 year, 18 month period before we open. So we take our time, but I think it's really worth it to not rush it, to really open when we're ready. And even when we open, we keep changing it all the time. So it is. I mean, even Blind Man's Song that we're touring at the moment. You know, we opened last January as part of the London International Mime Festival, and it's changed a huge amount. When we opened, we thought, oh, that's it, it's finished, and then we've changed it again when we went to Edinburgh, and we changed it again when we came here. We just finished a 3-week London run, and it's changed again. So when we're going to arrive in Oxford, it's going to be even different, which is great. It's a good
Fantastic.
change.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for speaking to me.
No, thank you for your wonderful question, Katie, and it's great to be able to chat about it.
Yeah. Brilliant.